Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for the invitation, having a very nice visit here today. I am a mathematician by training. All of my degrees are in math. When I was doing my PhD, I started hanging around engineers, and when I was doing a postdoc, I started hanging around biologists. And essentially what I do now is try to put those two ideas together with a mathematical foundation, which is my end background. So I'm going to talk about control theory, system control theory, thinking about automatic feedback systems, regulation of technological systems, and systems biology, which is better described as molecular systems biology, which is thinking about networks of interacting biochemical and genetic components. So I'll do my best to introduce these ideas in a broad sense as we move forward. Okay, so the first thing I'd like to address is a question that might come up from the title, which is how is it that ideas from engineering, particular control theoretic ideas from engineering, can apply to answer basic questions in biology? So there are natural places for engineering to make contributions to biology, or to science in general, for instance, in instrumentation and in data analysis and that sort of thing. But there is a distinction between science and engineering. Engineering has to do with building new things, building technologies, and typically the tools that are developed for those design aspects of engineering don't speak directly to basic scientific questions. Though we often don't get to ask the why question in science. Things are the way they are, and we try to sort out the way they are, but we don't often get to ask why they are the way they are. In biology, we have an exception in that the biological systems that we have before us have been selected, and so in a sense have been designed, not by a rational design the way that we have put together our own technologies, but this sort of random, well, not entirely random, but directed random search, if you like, through evolution. And so one can ask the why questions. Why is it that this particular biological system is before us as opposed to another one? Why has this been selected over that one? And so that's the design angle that allows ideas from engineering to bear directly onto these basic biological questions. In particular, it allows us to make analogies between technologies that we have developed and technologies that have come out of essentially biological evolutionary design, if you'll let me call it that. So some trivial examples are here. This is really mimicry. So here's flippers that were designed based on waterfowl feet. Velcro, famously designed on these sticky seed burrs. A far more interesting example is this. So this is a rotary motor. It's roughly on the order of 100 years old, depending on how you define things. It might sit in the palm of my hand or be much larger. And this is a rotary motor, which has been around for billions of years and spans the membrane of a bacterium, so measured on a nanoscale. They're made of different things, made of different materials. They run on different energy sources, but in many ways, they do the same job. And so this is a sort of photograph. Here we have a schematic of this device. And it's a rotary motor in a mechanical sense. It's got a rotor that rotates in a stator, a bushing that connects to a drive shaft. And the point I want to make here is that having spent a long time thinking about the way these things work, thinking about the design and construction of these objects, we have built up a set of tools, theoretical tools, that we can use to analyze the behavior of this device, essentially reverse engineer its behavior. Now, just to put this in context, this is the flagellar motor from an E. coli bacterium, which spins these long flagella that let it swim around. And I discovered this afternoon that William Ryu, who I think is here, but I don't see him, is an expert. So if you have any questions about this particular system, I'm not going to be able to address them, but William would. Another example that's more germane to what I want to talk about today is this. So this is another piece of human design technology. It's a wiring diagram, as you recognize, and it belongs to a Kenwood range. So we see some pieces we recognize. Here's a battery. Here's the heater. There's a buzzer there. And people in this room will recognize as the individual pieces as well. So we've got resistors and capacitors and diodes and so forth. And if you spend a long time studying these things, for instance, if you had a background in electrical engineering, you'd be able to look at this diagram and make sense of the way it behaves. And you could get some insight into why it was designed the way it was. Right, so I don't have that background, and I presume some of you might. But the idea simply is that we have a set of tools that allow us to address the behavior of this rather complicated-looking system. So the analogy I want to make is not that there are Kenwood ranges inside cells, but that there are similar-looking complicated networks. So here's one. This is a protein-protein interaction diagram. So the nodes on this graph indicate individual proteins. And the edges on the graph, which connect these proteins, suggest that somehow they interact with one another. So this is all results of wet lab biology. This is people actually in the lab sorting out how these things behave. And then you put all that information together, and you get a picture that looks like this. To put this in context, P53, which is the main player in this network, is implicated in a number of cancer pathways. And again, so the analogy there is really not on the level of the materials that this is made from or the particular function that behaves, but the question of whether or not the tools will apply. Another example is this. So this is a different kind of biological technology. This is a genetic regulatory network. The nodes here are not proteins, but rather genes. So these horizontal bars represent individual genes. The arrow that comes off the gene represents a gene product, that is the protein that's coded by the gene. And wherever that arrow is incident on another gene, for instance over here, that's indicating that the protein product is either upregulating or downregulating the expression of that gene, essentially turning on or off the expression of the protein that other gene codes for. So we can think of this as a dynamic system. Think of a bank of light bulbs being the genes on or off. And there's a rule, you can imagine just a Boolean rule as the simplest instance, telling you which light bulbs will be on in the next instant, and rules telling you which light bulbs turn one another off. So that's basically a very simple model of what's going on here. That dynamic pathway is part of a developmental process where this organism here, which I won't try to pronounce, it's a purple sea urchin, develops from a single cell to a full animal. So this is just a small part of that process. And again, painstakingly developed individual interactions here. We put these together, we get something that on the face of it looks unintelligible, but the connection we have between these three is that we have these theoretical tools from systems and control theory, which have been designed specifically to analyze and primarily forward engineer complicated networks like this. And the argument I want to make is that we can apply those same ideas appropriately modified to systems like this or like this. So that's the starting point for the analysis. I should say, if there are any comments or questions, I'd be happy to pause along the way if anything's unclear. Okay, so before moving to the main story, I'd like to say a bit about how these networks are implemented and how they actually perform their functions. Because I want to think of these really as technologies, and they look sort of magical without a bit of context. And so I want to think of sort of chemistry as a starting point and ask, how is it that we get these technological devices, these networks that have functions, that have roles, that can be robust in their roles, how do they actually work? And so I'll take as a starting point the distinction between a chemical network and a biochemical network, which potentially could act as a device. So here's a caricature of a chemical network. So I've got a number of species here. You can imagine throwing them into a beaker and shaking it up, waiting for a while and seeing what happens. And I'm indicating a bunch of possible reactions between them. Now, this is really a caricature since I've got all unimolecular reactions here, but just to make the picture simple, that's the idea. So that's a scientific object, if you like, this network. I want to move, sorry, a chemical object, if you like. I want to move above that. So the first distinction I can make between a biochemical network and a chemical network is that of all these possible chemical processes that could go on, a cell gets to decide which ones happen. So the cell gets to choose from that pool of possibilities the reactions that are going to occur. And the way it does that is it generates catalysts for particular reactions, and it doesn't generate catalysts for others. So those catalysts are proteins called enzymes. The word enzyme is just the name for a protein that acts as a catalyst. And the idea here is that in this particular case, the cell would be expressing a protein that catalyzes this reaction and not expressing one that catalyzes this reaction. And here, whether or not the reaction occurs is really a question of time scale. So these enzyme catalysis is remarkably efficient. It can increase the rate of reactions 1,000-fold, 1,000,000-fold or more. And so essentially what we're doing is we're taking these reactions that have been chosen and speeding them up to the point that they're relevant to the biological time scale. So the other ones may be occurring, but they're occurring so slowly that essentially they're absent. So that's the first thing, is that we get to, from all this these chemical possibilities, we get to select certain aspects that we're going to allow to occur. The next, which again gets us closer to the idea of function, is a distinction from this system being thermodynamically closed. So again, I've got this system in my test tube, if you like. Biochemical systems and life in general is thermodynamically open. So there's material that passes in and out. There's energy that passes in and out. And so if I take this chemical system and make it into an open system, for instance here by introducing some mass transfer, I get something that stops, that starts to look less like a chemical possibilities and starts to look like a device. This thing seems to have a function now. What's its function? Well, it takes S1 from the environment and it turns it into S11 and S16. And again, it's that idea of imposing function onto what was previously just sort of a scientific fact that allows us to bring some engineering ideas to bear. Now, beyond that, the ideas I want to talk about today are these ideas of interconnections, and we have on top of this functional behavior of what this what the flow through this network is achieving, we also have regulation of that behavior, which we see regularly in these biochemical networks. And the way that's established is, there are two different ways that's established. One is that the amount of enzyme that's catalyzing these reactions can be regulated, and that occurs on a slower time scale. So on a slow time scale, essentially, if you like, the thickness of these arrows could be modified. But on a chemical time scale, there's also a means for regulation. That's the first story I want to tell you about today has to do with this implementation. So what we have here is a particular chemical in the pathway, metabolite, which is somehow able to inhibit, this blunt arrow meaning inhibit the rate of one of these reactions. Okay, so on the chemical level, we have chemicals interacting with one another in such a way that they're performing a particular function, and they are regulating the way in which that function proceeds. Okay, so and that's really brings us to the direct analogy to the kind of automatic feedback systems that we design within our own technologies. Okay, so that's again the analogy we make, and what I want to do now is just say a few words about how this chemical interaction can occur, again, because it seems a bit magical if you haven't been exposed to these ideas. So the starting point there, I just have a couple slides on this. The starting point is enzyme catalysis. If you've seen first-year biochemistry or cell biology, this will be a familiar picture. So the way enzymes work, this is a sort of standard metaphor, is a lock-and-key mechanism where I've got my enzyme here, I've got some particular substrate. The reaction that's occurring is this orange guy is turning into the yellow guy and the purple guy, and that reaction would occur in the absence of the enzyme. What the enzyme does is it binds a substrate at a particular spot on the enzyme called the active or catalytic site, and having bound, it reduces the transition energy essentially to get from this state to this state. So in this picture, we can just sort of mechanically think of once this guy's bound, these green arms provide a little bit of tension, for instance, and help separate this into these two pieces. I mean, that's sort of just a simple mechanical metaphor. Okay, so that's basically the way enzymes work. The observation we make is that the enzyme is unchanged by the reaction. It's able to catalyze another reaction immediately afterwards. Then the question comes, how can chemicals like these metabolites that are involved in the reactions, regulate the activity of the enzyme? How can they have an impact on the rate at which this catalysis is occurring? So there's one rather direct mechanism, and then there's one that's much more subtle and much more powerful. So the direct mechanism is what's called competitive inhibition. And the idea here is relatively straightforward. So here's the natural path. I've got this enzyme, it binds a substrate here, that's my catalytic complex of enzyme substrate, and then this product is formed. What I have as an inhibitor is this blue guy here who looks sufficiently like the substrate, it's a mimic of the substrate, that it binds to the active site as well, but it doesn't do anything, it just sits there. And so it clogs up the enzyme. And then this guy is inactive, and if you have enough of these guys around, you'll get most of your enzymes in the inactive state, and then your reaction essentially will cease because the catalysts won't be available. Okay, so this is a simple way to have this chemical mimic turn off an enzyme. And there are lots of examples of this. Lots of poisons and drugs work this way. Aspirin works this way. It clogs up an enzyme that generates prostaglandins, which are involved in pain pathways. So you have this direct effect where these individual chemicals, if they have the right shape, can inhibit enzyme activity. That's a nice simple chemical story. The biological story that provides a far richer example of the way this regulation can occur is referred to as allosteric regulation. So allostery, the phrase was coined from the Greek other shape, and the idea is that the regulator has a different shape from the substrate. So the story here is that I have an enzyme which has two sites that can bind some molecules here. The substrate binds at the catalytic site. That's the story we had before. I have another site that's removed from the catalytic site where another molecule binds, and that's this allosteric, in this case, inhibitor. And the idea is that having bound here, that binding event induces a conformational change in the enzyme. So I'll in the next slide, I'll talk about how that conformational change would occur. But having changed its shape, in this case, the active site has changed its shape to the point where the substrate doesn't fit anymore. Again, this is just a cartoon metaphor. In that case, I've turned the enzyme off because the substrate can't get in. The enzyme can't perform its catalytic function. Okay? So the advantage here of having this site distinct from this site is, first of all, I don't have to have this guy be a mimic of this chemically. It can have an arbitrary chemical composition. But the other advantage here is a richness in terms of the overall function. So instead of having this guy bind to close the site, I could have reversed this picture. So I could have had the site being open down here, the active enzyme being the one that is regulated, and the inactive enzyme being the one that's not regulated. So in addition to turning things off with this allosteric mechanism, you can also turn things on. Moreover, you can combine these signals. So a single protein, a single enzyme, can have multiple allosteric sites. Again, because they don't have to be on the active site. They can be all over the place. And there are lots of examples where there are multiple allosteric regulators. And so essentially what you can have is this conformational change through the body of the enzyme, allowing the integration of multiple signals from these chemicals which are part of your pathway to the overall response, which is essentially the character of that catalytic site. And so from the point of view of designing feedbacks within this network, allostery really gives you sort of a rich set of possibilities in terms of having positive feedback, in terms of having negative feedback, in terms of having feedbacks of different strengths and different interaction feedbacks, etc. And so it really opens the door in terms of the way that these systems can be designed and hence can be regulated. And there are lots of the examples of these things that are found naturally. Okay, so the question that I have left out, which again potentially is mysterious, is how is it that this binding of this molecule here leads to this conformational change? And that follows from the fact that proteins, which are these macromolecules, are not as rigid as we sort of usually think of simple molecules being. They're relatively fluid. They are made up of strings of amino acids. So amino acids are stringed onto this polypeptide chain. And they take a three-dimensional configuration, which gives them their function. And they take that simply by essentially minimizing their energy. So you've got this string of molecules on a chain. Some are hydrophobic, some are hydrophilic, some are slightly positive or negatively charged. And that chain then essentially just sort of winds into its minimum energy state in this aqueous environment. And that is the 3D configuration. So that's the protein folding problem, which is a huge problem that we're not very good at predicting the way that goes yet, which is a pity because we have lots of the information about the order of the amino acids. That's that comes from sequencing genomes. So what we have I should describe this. So this is this backbone essentially describing a protein. And what these images represent is the fact that these proteins can take different shapes essentially according to the current minimum energy state. So the idea here is I've got somebody transitioning between two states. Here we've got a protein which is in its minimum energy state, but when this guy binds, that induces essentially there's a change in the landscape here. So for instance, I've got a positively charged atom that suddenly is next to another positively charged atom, and so they repel one another a little bit, and that leads to local changes which, because of the way the protein is put together, can actually lead to these rather large, rather significant changes in its structure. And so we have this mechanism that allows for these chemical interactions, which don't have to be constrained in any particular way, to lead to whatever sort of change in behavior we would like, of course, within chemical constraints. But there's really a very rich class of examples of this that have been discovered. Okay, so that's how the devices are put together, in a sense. So what I'd like to talk about now is the main story. And really, I want to tell you one story twice, in two different biological contexts, and in a static and then a dynamic regime. And when we get to the dynamic regime here, I need to introduce this notion of the frequency response, which is just a Fourier transform. So we can think of it as spectral density. So that'll just be a quick detour there. Okay, so the first story here is about negative feedback. Sorry, both stories are about negative feedback and about how we can introduce robustness through negative feedback. So this one, there's a preprint there if anyone's curious at Archive. And the biological context here is signal transduction pathways. So a signal transduction pathway is a way in which a cell can take information from its environment and respond appropriately by inducing some change in the cell's state. The standard story is described here. So I've got some external signals. And the simplest example is to think about a chemical cue in the environment. There's some protein-protein interaction networks that involve essentially signal processing. So those are of the kind that I showed at the beginning of the talk there. And what I want to talk about in this story is a particular motif that is found in those networks and found in a number of different organisms and in different processes. So it's conserved across different organisms, conserved across different pathways, and so there's some argument that whatever it's doing, it must be doing it fairly well to have been selected over and over again or to be retained as opposed to alternative devices. And these things are made of a ring of three, cascade of three enzyme cycles. I'll show that in a minute on the next slide. And they tend to be towards the end of this signal processing component. And so the idea there is that these may be acting as amplifiers. So I've got some signal processing that's going on sort of small levels of chemicals of these molecules, and then I've got some amplification which is required before I can induce the appropriate cellular response. So I want to think about these things as amplifiers. How is it that they amplify? Well, this is again a standard textbook story. So here I've got a blow up of this cycle, and the way these things work is I have an enzyme which is activated by my chemical cue from the environment, and I've left out the signal processing network here. And then we've got that enzyme is able to activate the one downstream, and that one, once activated, activates the next one. And so the amplification here is I tell my friends, they tell their friends sort of amplification, because each enzyme on this step can catalyze a number on this step, each one on this step catalyzes a number down here, and finally we get these guys catalyzing the actual response of the cell. So that's the idea of these as amplifiers, and that's a fairly well understood idea. What came out recently from a couple of different groups in a couple of different contexts was an observation that in some cases there's a negative feedback wrapped around this cascade. Okay, so in some cases there are, and it depends, the context, the specifics depend on the context, but there is an element near the bottom of the cascade that has a negative impact on activity near the top of the cascade. Okay, so that came as a bit of a surprise, because I think people, the standard wisdom is that these are acting as amplifiers, then it would be, it's unclear why you would want to wrap a negative feedback around it. That's going to reduce the gain of the amplifier. It's not going to work as well as an amplifier. So again, if you think about these things as being selected, that is essentially having been designed, one would think there's got to be a good reason for that negative feedback to be there. So some hypotheses were suggested. It was suggested that maybe it's involved in deactivation of the pathway, so it allows it to turn off faster than it would otherwise. Alternatively, it could be that it would allow it to turn off even if the signal is persistent. So the cell may want a transient response to a persistent signal, and perhaps that negative feedback would be involved in that deactivation. Another hypothesis was that this is a delayed feedback and hence could lead to oscillations, and oscillations have been implicated in a couple of different instances in signal transduction. So those are all possibilities that were put forth. What I'd like to suggest some evidence for is an alternative pathway, alternative hypothesis, excuse me, proposed by my colleague Herbert Sauer, who's now at University of Washington, that in fact the negative feedback is here to enhance the function of this cascade as an amplifier and turn it into what's called the negative feedback amplifier, which is a standard component in electronics. So what I want to do now is convince you that wrapping negative feedback on an amplifier is a good thing to do, having just said that it seems like a bad thing to do. Okay, so what we need to do here is just a very simple analysis, just simple linear static analysis of a negative feedback amplifier. So here's my simplest model. I can imagine I've got some input U, some output Y, and my system is simply a multiplicative gain by this gain A. So I've just got a multiplicative process there. And I want to ask what happens when I wrap a negative feedback around that. So again, I'm going to take the simplest model I can imagine. I've just got this gain F on the output, and I'm subtracting that from the input. Okay, so the first question is, well, how are now are the input and the output related to one another? And to answer that question, we just walk around this block diagram. So here's the feedback times the output. I subtract that from the input. I pass that through the amplifier, and that's supposed to be the output. So I have this implicit relationship between my input and my output, and I solve for the system behavior. And as one would have guessed, it does indeed have a smaller gain than my amplifier before I wrap the feedback around it, right? So I've got this what's called the loop gain AF, which is involved in this denominator. So this denominator is larger than 1, and so the gain has been reduced from A to 1 plus AF. Okay, so yes, it's reduced the gain of the amplifier. It doesn't work as well as an amplifier. What's the point of putting that there? Well, the history is these were originally... this idea was originally proposed by a man named Harold Black, who was an engineer at Bell Labs in the late 20s. They were laying long-distance telephone lines across the United States, and the signals were being amplified by vacuum tube amplifiers, and the amplifiers themselves were very difficult to characterize. Their behavior would change with age. They would depend on the local weather conditions and such. And so they were really having trouble not with the degree of amplification, but with the sensitivity of their system behavior to the characteristics of the amplifier. So Black's observation was that when you wrap this negative feedback around, you improve the behavior of the system in a real environment. And so we can look at that through some simple analysis here. If I consider the effect of an internal variation. So suppose I take this gain A, so this is some system that's been lumped into that single gain, and I imagine that there's some internal variation, either in a vacuum tube or in this cascade of proteins. So let me take this A and drop it, say, by 1%. So if I drop that gain by 1% and I don't have any feedback, then of course, for a given input, the output drops by 1%. That's immediate. What we see, if we have the feedback in place, that when I drop the gain by 1%, the output doesn't drop by 1%, but rather 1 over 1 plus AF percent. So here, I'm just taking a derivative here of the output with respect to A. That's all this is, this parametric sensitivity. What we see then is that the factor that we reduce the gain by, which is 1 over 1 plus AF, is also the factor by which we reduce the system sensitivity to failures, unmodeled dynamics, changes in the character of that amplifier. So it seems that we have introduced something useful here. We've introduced this robustness to the functioning of this device by connecting it in feedback with this device. And the same thing happens if we look at, for instance, the effect of external disturbances here. So we have, say, some sort of load on our signal. Again, in the absence of feedback, of course, that's a direct effect. And in the presence of feedback, the system is essentially able to respond to that load, and we get this same attenuation of the disturbance. So that seems like this actually is a good thing to do. We've been able to introduce this robustness to these variations here. Now, the story is not quite as rosy as I've just suggested, and the issue is that robustness that we've introduced essentially comes at a price, and the price comes in considering what is the effect now of variation in this device, the one that we've just added. So, as I suggested here, the sensitivity to variations in the original amplifier is attenuated by this factor. If I ask what happens when I increase the gain of F by 1%, again, my output drops, and it drops by this factor here. Again, I'm just taking a derivative with respect to F here. And of course, we can see that those two numbers add up to 1. So the story is not that we've been able to introduce robustness. We've not able to make the system more robust than it was. Rather, we've been able to redistribute robustness within this conservation. So before, all the sensitivity was here in this device, and now what I've been able to do is take the sensitivity and essentially distribute it so that part of it lies here and part of it lies here, and it has to obey this conservation. Okay, so that's not quite as nice as we thought. We thought we were just introducing robustness. It turns out we're just redistributing it. This is what engineers refer to as a performance constraint. It's something they'd like to get past but can't, and so you have to work within it. And the way that feedback amplifiers are designed works within that constraint in the following way. The amplifiers are built more powerful than they need to be, so they have a higher gain A than you actually need. And they are built in such a way that one doesn't worry too much about their behavior. One doesn't worry too much about quality control. They can be mass-produced, etc. The feedback elements which don't have as much heavy lifting to do. They don't need to do the work of amplification, are designed and built much more precisely, and their characters are more carefully controlled, so that the disturbances that the system is likely to see don't have a major effect here. So the idea then is one takes advantage of this ability to redistribute sensitivity in the design of the device, essentially the design of the two pieces of the device. And so the conjecture here, if we bring this back to the biological context, is that the same thing could be happening here. And again, this is just a conjecture. This hasn't been experimentally tested. But here I've got this amplification device, which involves a number of pieces, each of which has to be regulated in some way. But there's a lot going on here, a lot of crosstalk going on that can affect this pathway. And I've got a single element here, which is involved in the negative feedback, which could be more tightly regulated than could be more easily tightly regulated than regulating this entire system. So again, we have redistribution that's allowed through the introduction of negative feedback, we have this possibility for the same kind of efficiency of design here in this biological context that we do in our technological designs. Okay, so that was story one, and what I want to do is essentially tell the same story in a dynamic context. And to do that, I just need to flash a few slides on what control engineers refer to as the frequency response, which again really is just a Fourier transform, so I don't need to introduce this. People here are familiar with this idea of spectral density. But I want to think of using that notion to generalize the sensitivity to perturbations. So what we looked at a moment ago was a perturbation that looked like this. It was a step change. I changed A from, say, 1 to 0.99. Right? I changed it by 1%. And I looked at, in the steady state, how does the system respond? So that was really just a derivative. What I want to do is ask whether I can look at a perturbation that isn't a step change, but rather has some dynamic character, and somehow describe the way the system responds, at least in long time. And if the system is linear, I can do that. So I need to restrict myself to a linear description here, which comes along with the requirement that I'm thinking about sort of small perturbations to a nonlinear system working in a linear regime. But if I do that, I can take advantage of what's called the frequency response, which follows from this property, that a linear system, so think of a system of differential equations, for instance, forced by some signals. When it's forced by a sinusoid of a particular frequency, responds, so a response to some aspect of that system, for instance, one of the state variables, responds with a sinusoid of the same frequency. So if you think about when you're teaching resonance, for instance, to undergrads, this is the kind of thing that you look at. Here's the picture, right? So I've got some sinusoidal forcing, which leads to some sinusoidal response. The things I have to keep track of, the things that could change, is the amplitude and the phase of the resulting signal. And this is in long time, I should say. This is after any transients from the initial condition. So what that means is, in terms of system behavior, I can characterize the way a linear system responds to sinusoidal inputs by keeping track of just two functions, the way the amplitude changes as a function of frequency and the way the phase changes as a function of frequency. So we call those the system gain and the phase shift. And that allows us to characterize then how the system responds to sinusoids. And if that was the whole story, it wouldn't be a terribly interesting story. But we can extend it because we can take an arbitrary perturbation, an arbitrary input, and through a spectral decomposition, describe it as a combination of sinusoids. Then we know how the system responds to each of those sinusoids in turn. It responds with a sinusoidal response. And so we could, if we wanted to, reconstruct the output from the system response to each of those individual sinusoids. And so essentially, that information about response to sinusoids contains all the information about any response to any signal whatsoever. And so we keep track of those two pieces of information, the system gain and the phase shift as a function of frequency, and that completely characterizes the behavior of a linear system. So there are a number of ways in which those are visualized. One is this, which is referred to as a Bode plot, named after the engineer who started drawing these things. And so what I have here as a function of frequency on a log scale, the gain of the system, I'm not plotting the phase shift, that's more relevant. We're talking about interacting devices here. I just want to think of a single device. And so I've got the gain here plotted as a function of frequency. One historical convention here is that the gain is plotted in decibels rather than in more rational units. That's an accident of engineering history. So there's a 20 pre-factor here. The 2 comes from the fact that these are typically applied to powers, so the square inside the logarithm becomes a 2, and the 10 comes from the deci, because they're decibels, not bells. So this is a minus 1 on a log scale, so that's 1/10. So the idea here is that this gain tells me how significantly, or rather, how the system amplifies or attenuates an input at a given sinusoidal a sinusoidal input at a given frequency. And the way I read this is I take an arbitrary signal and I look at its spectral decomposition, and I ask, is it heavily weighted at high frequencies or low frequencies, for instance? And then I say, well, if it's mostly composed of high-frequency components, then over here I can see that the system's mostly going to be attenuated at this degree. If it's mostly made up of low-frequency components, slowly varying components, then it's going to be roughly mostly attenuated at this level. That's essentially how these things are read. And it's this as a tool of measuring system response that I want to introduce this other trade-off in robustness. So the other observation I wanted to make here is that if I look at low frequency, think of a sinusoid at zero frequency, that's a constant. And so the response to a constant perturbation, that is, say, a step change, can be read off here at essentially the zero frequency. Of course, it's a log scale. There's not actually zero here. But in the limit, we see that response to a constant, which was just our standard derivative, parametric sensitivity here. And in the electrical engineering jargon, that's referred to as a DC gain, DC for direct current, as opposed to AC, which involves these sinusoids at different frequencies. Okay, so if we apply that tool to the response of that MAPK pathway, I forgot to introduce its name. Anyway, that signal subduction pathway, we see the following. So here at low frequency, we get what we expect. We saw that the feedback makes the system more robust to disturbances. So here I've got a disturbance in the input itself, and I'm seeing that when I introduce feedback, I have a certain amplification of gain. And again, that's not a 50 on a log scale. It's really just a 2.5 on a log scale, which is still significant but not crazy. As opposed to when I didn't have feedback. So that's what we saw before, that when we look at these step changes and we look at the long-time system response, feedback had the effect of introducing this robustness, of making the system less sensitive to those perturbations. What we see if we look at over the whole frequency range here, that is that there's a crossover point where the feedback actually is making the system more sensitive to that disturbance than in the case when there was no feedback. And so it's that ability of this negative feedback to introduce sensitivity on this dynamic scale that I'd like to put in context. And again, there's a robustness here. Sorry, there's a trade-off in robustness here that can be made explicit. So I want to tell that story in the context of an alternative biological example. This is the glycolytic pathway. So this is a metabolic pathway. The joint work, I should say, with some colleagues at Caltech. Again, this is a very standard pathway. If you've seen any biochemistry or molecular biology, this will be familiar. Glycolysis is the pathway by which the sugar glucose is broken down to yield energy in the form of ATP molecules and other energy-rich molecules. We're going to think of ATP as the primary output here, energy as the output, which it is in certain contexts. And what I want to focus on is a particular negative feedback here. There are several feedbacks, as you can see, both feedforward and feedback, positive and negative. But I want to focus on one negative feedback whereby ATP, which we can think of as the output, that's the energy currency for the cell, is feeding back and inhibiting the rate of one of these reactions. So that's a negative feedback regulation. Think about this, the same sort of thing we saw with our amplifier. Think about like a cruise control. The standard story is cruise control in a car, right? If you're going too fast, it slows you down. If you're going too slow, it speeds up. So this ATP, which is the output, essentially throttles production of ATP if there's a lot of it around, and it inhibits production. And it increases the level of production if the levels are low. And again, this is one of these allosteric regulations that I introduced at the beginning of the hour. Okay, so what I want to do is think about the dynamic effect of that negative feedback. And in order to do so, I need to construct a little model here of that pathway. So this is just a sort of block, a lumped block description of the way that model's going to look. Here's the pathway. the pieces I want to focus on here. I've got a disturbance here, which will be an increase in ATP consumption, so that'll actually be a negative disturbance here. And the feedback here wraps from ATP, my output, to this enzyme phosphofructokinase, and I'm going to modulate the gain of that feedback by this parameter N. So this is this negative feedback modulated by this this parameter N. The details of the model come from a standard ODE-based description of these systems. They start from a mass action point of view, so we think of the cell as a well-stirred reactor, which is, of course, a gross approximation, but is a reasonable approximation, particularly in looking at metabolism. So we have a differential equation that describes the the concentration of the individual metabolites in the pathway, the chemicals in the pathway. The differential equation simply says that the rate of change is the rate of production minus the rate of consumption, and those rates are given by what's called a Michaelis-Menten kinetics, which depends on the availability of substrate in a hyperbolic fashion. So here, this is the rate at which this as metabolite Xi is consumed, and this function increases for small levels of Xi, increases linearly, and saturates to this value Vmax. So that's just a standard setup for describing these kinetics. And the one wrinkle we have here is this guy, phosphofructokinase, which is the regulated one, has the regulation appearing. Again, this is a standard model referred to as a Hill equation here, where ATP, which is the negative regulator, is appearing in the denominator, and that gain N is appearing here as an exponent. So I'm going to vary that gain N and see how that stronger feedback has an effect on the system behavior. And here's what I get if I run some simulations. So I've set the system up so that the nominal level of ATP is 1, so I'm just normalizing here. And what I do is I kick it with a disturbance, which is a step increase in the consumption of ATP. So the cell's maybe undergone some stress and needs more energy. And so it's kicking up its need for energy. ATP level is being depleted from somewhere else in the cellular environment, intracellular environment. And I want to see how the system responds. So if there's no feedback, N equals 0, well, the ATP levels drop, and they drop to this new steady state because the system doesn't know that the ATP levels are being ATP is being consumed at a different rate. There's no feedback. Alternatively, once I introduce this feedback, say, for instance, at N equal 1, I get what I expect. If I look here at the steady state response, I'm much closer to the pre-disturbance level than I was in the absence of feedback. So the system's responding to the fact that the ATP levels have dropped. The negative feedback is alleviating that pressure on that enzyme. Essentially, we're getting increased production. So it's doing what we'd expect it to do. If I increase the strength of that feedback, the gain of that feedback, I get better and better behavior here at N equal 2, N equal 3. I get closer and closer to this pre-disturbance level. And you would expect, in some cases it's true, in this case it's not for this nonlinear system, you'd expect that you get closer and closer as you increase that gain towards infinity. What happens, in fact, is if we go a little bit higher, a bit before 4, we go into sustained oscillations here. And we get a hint of that if we look here at the transient behavior, which leads to this nice long-time behavior. So at N equal 1, we see there's a bit of an overshoot. So the system ATP levels drop, and the system takes a little bit of time to respond, and then we get this response here. At N equal 2, we get that overshoot, but we also get this sort of damped oscillation, which leads us there. At N equal 3, that ringing takes a long time to settle out. And again, as I suggested, we go a little bit further, we actually end up with these sustained oscillations. So what we're seeing here is essentially a trade-off between good behavior in the steady state, in the long-time regime, and more and more poor behavior in the short-time regime. And so that trade-off that I'd like to suggest can be made explicit, and it's much easier to see how it can be made explicit if I look at this picture not in the time domain, but rather in the frequency domain. So what I want to do is take the Fourier transform of these signals and compare them, and that's this picture here. So what I've got here is not the spectrum itself, but I'm normalizing against the N equals 0 case. So I've set that, I'm normalizing against that, so that's here at 0. And what I'm doing then is looking at the relative response of the system to these spectral components of the input. And here at low frequency, that is long time behavior, we're seeing what we expected. The steady state response to the step change is characterized by this limit at 0. We're seeing that at N equal 1, N equal 2, N equal 3, we get this nice improved response at low frequency. But of course, you're seeing also that's coming at a price of a poorer and poorer response at higher frequency. Again, so this is suggesting that the spectral components of the input, of the disturbance, which are present here at this higher frequency range, are being amplified more and more by this increased strength of feedback. And so there's the ringing effects that we saw on the previous slide. And here you see something that really looks like a trade-off and can be made explicit. So the result called Bode's integral formula, which makes this explicit for linear systems under certain technical conditions, which provides precisely the trade-off you're seeing here. It says that the integral here is bounded below. So this is referred to as a waterbed effect. What it says is when you push down the sensitivity over one frequency regime, it necessarily bumps up over another frequency regime. And again, this is something you really can't get around. It's something you have to work within. And so this is what engineers do when they're designing these regulatory interactions that are going to provide robustness to their system, is they don't get to take this sensitivity and remove it. All they get to do is they get to move it around. And so, again, this is a constraint that technological systems have to work within and that biological systems have to work within. So how is it that our own technologies work within, our own designs work within those constraints? Similar idea to the constraint we saw before, where we had this redistribution in the static case between components, is one looks at the system of interest, one tries to characterize the kind of disturbances it's likely to encounter, and then one designs a feedback structure so that the sensitivity is low over the frequency components it's likely to be excited at. And necessarily, that's introducing sensitivity over other frequency ranges. And then you kind of cross your fingers and you hope I'm being facetious, but you design things in such a way that it's unlikely that those other modes are going to be excited. So you are introducing sensitivities, but you introduce sensitivities that are innocuous in the sense that they're not likely to be excited by the system in normal operation. So that same message essentially applies to regulation of biochemical systems. And if we think about systems that are very tightly regulated, for instance, the ATP level in the cell, which is the energy currency for the cell, so that has to be very tightly regulated for a number of reasons, one might think that a tight regulation of that system would lead to, yes, good, nice, robust behavior over the kinds of disturbances that it's been exposed to through its design phase, essentially, that is, in the environments it's been exposed to over evolutionary time. But then if you start poking it in different ways, for instance, putting it in the lab and exposing it to disturbances that it hasn't encountered over that, quote, design phase, it's very likely that you're going to excite these sensitivities that are necessarily in place in order to provide that tight regulation. And so one possibility here, again, comes in the form of these glycolytic pathways. So this glycolytic system can be induced into sustained oscillations, which don't seem to have a physiological purpose and may indeed be a side effect of that tight regulation that is there in order to essentially protect the ATP level in response to disturbances that the cell normally is exposed to. Okay. And then I can go till 5, is that all right? Well, okay. I've got one coda here, which is the theory. I wasn't sure whether I have time to mention this. I'll go very briefly. A coda here is that this theory can be extended to consider also the effect of positive feedback, which generally has a destabilizing effect. And again, that can be illustrated by this system. So in addition to a negative feedback, a negative allosteric regulation of the ATP output on this enzyme, there's also a positive feedback in the property that ATP is actually a substrate for that reaction. So the glycolysis is turbocharged in the sense that it uses energy to make energy. And so that recursive effect can lead to oscillation. So for instance, coal plants that use the energy they produce to run themselves can sometimes go into these unfortunate oscillations because of the delayed feedback that's introduced there. This positive feedback, again, essentially has a destabilizing effect. One can take Bode's integral formula, which said that this was equal to zero. Sorry, I've got this into the discrete setting here. And essentially what happens is you introduce extra terms which come in with a positive sign as a result of this positive feedback, meaning essentially that trade-off that said that the integral was bounded below now says it's bounded below by something that's larger. And so essentially you aggravate that trade-off. So when you introduce this instability in the body of this positive feedback, you again have a trade-off, but the trade-off is sort of working at a worse starting point, if you like. Okay, that was quick. All right, so the conclusion again, just this idea of introducing negative feedback allows for redistribution of robustness, not introduction of robustness. And the redistribution we can think of either from sort of component to component or over time scales we saw through Bode's integral formula. Okay, so I'll stop there. So thank you very much for your time.